Trondheim is bigger than most realize, and there are many strange things within it. Rooms, people, creatures, forgotten artifacts. As I wandered, I thought, and I came to know myself better than ever I had before. One day, I discovered a room somewhere high in Trondheim. I doubt I could locate it again, even if I tried. A beam of sunlight seemed to pour into the room, though the ceiling was solid, and in the center of the room was a pedestal, and upon the pedestal was growing a single flower. I do not know what kind of flower it was. I have never seen its like before or since. The petals were purple, but the center of the blossom was like a drop of blood. There were thorns upon the stem, and the flower exuded the most wonderful scent, and seemed to hum with a music all its own. It was such an amazing and unlikely thing to find. I stayed in the room, staring at the flower for longer than I can remember, and it was then and there that I was finally able to put words to who I was and who I am. I would like to see that flower some day. Perhaps you will.
Arya glanced toward the Varden's camp.
I should go. There is much yet to be done.
He nodded. We'll see you tomorrow, then.
Tomorrow.
Arya began to walk away. After a few steps, she paused and looked back.
I'm glad that Saphira chose you as her rider, Aragorn, and I'm proud to have fought alongside you. You have become more than any of us dared hope. Whatever happens tomorrow, know that.
Then she resumed her stride, and soon she disappeared around the curve of the hill, leaving him alone with Saphira and the Aldenari. Fire in the Night. When darkness fell, Aragorn cast a spell to hide himself. Then he patted Saphira on the nose and set out on foot for the Varden's camp.
Be careful, she said.
Invisible as he was, it was easy to slip past the warriors who kept watch around the periphery of the camp. As long as he was quiet, and as long as the men did not catch sight of his footprints or shadows, he could move about freely. He wound his way between the woolen tents until he found Roran and Katrina's. He rapped his knuckles against the central pole, and Roran popped his head out.
Where are you?
Whispered Roran.
Hurry in!
Releasing the flow of magic, Aragorn revealed himself. Roran flinched, then grabbed him by the arm and pulled him into the dark interior of the tent.
Welcome, Aragorn, said Katrina, rising from where she sat on their tiny cot. Katrina, it's good to see you again. She gave him a quick embrace.
Will this take long?
Roran asked. Aragorn shook his head.
It shouldn't.
Squatting on his heels, he thought for a moment, then began to chant softly in the ancient language. First he placed spells around Katrina to protect her against any who might harm her. He made the spells more extensive than he had originally planned, in an attempt to ensure that she and her unborn child would be able to escape Galbatorix's forces should something happen to both him and Roran. These wards will shield you from a certain number of attacks, he told her. I can't tell you how many exactly, because it depends on the strength of the blows or spells. I've given you another defense as well. If you're in danger, say the word Frethia 2 times, and you'll vanish from sight.
Frethia, she murmured.
Exactly.
It won't hide you completely, however. The sounds you make can still be heard, and your footprints will still be visible. No matter what happens, don't go into water, or your position will be obvious at once. The spell will draw its energy from you, which means that you'll tire faster than usual, and I wouldn't recommend sleeping while it's active. You might not wake up again. To end the spell, simply say, Frethia Letta.
Frethia Letta.
Good. Then Aragorn turned his attention to Roran. He spent longer placing the wards around his cousin, for it was likely Roran would confront a greater number of threats. And he endowed the spells with more energy than he thought Roran would have approved of, but Aragorn did not care. He could not bear the thought of defeating Galbatorix, only to find that Roran had died during the battle. Afterward, he said,
I did something different this time, something I should have thought of long ago. In addition to the usual wards, I gave you a few that will feed directly off your own strength. As long as you're alive, they'll shield you from danger. But, he lifted a finger, they'll only activate once the other wards are exhausted. And if the demands placed upon them are too great, you'll fall unconscious and then you'll die.
So in trying to save me, they may kill me, Roran asked.
Aragorn nodded. Don't let anyone drop another wall on you and you'll be fine. It's a risk, but worth it, I think, if it keeps a horse from trampling you or a javelin from going through you. Also, I gave you the same spell as Katrina. All you have to do is say Frethia twice and Frethia letter to turn yourself invisible and visible at will. He shrugged. You might find that useful during the battle.
Roran gave an evil chuckle.
That I will. Just make sure the elves don't mistake you for one of Galbatorix's spellcasters. As Aragorn rose to his feet, Katrina stood as well. She surprised him by grasping one of his hands and pressing it against her chest. Thank you, Aragorn, she said softly. You're a good man. He flushed, embarrassed. It's nothing. Guard yourself well tomorrow. You mean a great deal to both of us, and I expect you to be around to act the doting uncle for our child. I'll be most put out if you get yourself killed.
He laughed. Don't worry. Saphira won't let me do anything foolish.
Good. She kissed him on both cheeks, then released him. Farewell, Katrina.
Roran accompanied him outside. Motioning toward the tent, Roran said, Thank you.
I'm glad I could help.
They gripped each other by the forearms and hugged. Then Roran said, Luck be with you. Aragorn took a long, unsteady breath.
Luck be with you.
He tightened his grip on Roran's forearm, reluctant to let go, for he knew that they might never meet again.
If Saphira and I don't come back, he said, will you see to it that we're buried at home? I wouldn't want our bones to lie here.
Roran raised his brows.
Saphira would be difficult to lug all the way back. The elves would help, I'm sure.
Then yes, I promise. Is there anywhere in particular you would like?
The top of the Bald Hill, said Aragorn, referring to a foothill near their farm. The bare-topped hill had always seemed like an excellent location for a castle, something they had discussed at great length when younger.
Roran nodded.
And if I don't come back, we'll do the same for you. That's not what I was going to ask. If I don't, you'll see to Katrina? Of course, you know that.
Aye, but I had to be sure. They gazed at each other for another minute. Finally, Roran said, We'll be expecting you for dinner tomorrow.
I'll be there.
Then Roran slipped back into the tent, leaving Aragorn standing alone in the night. He looked up at the stars and felt a touch of grief, as if he had already lost someone close to him. After a few moments, he padded away into the shadows, relying upon the darkness to conceal him. He searched through the camp until he found the tent Horst and Elaine shared with their baby girl, Hope. The three of them were still awake, as the infant was crying.
Aragorn,
Horst exclaimed softly, when Aragorn made his presence known.
Come in, come in. We haven't seen much of you since Dras Leona. How are you?
Aragorn spent the better part of an hour talking with them. He did not tell them of the Eldunari, but he did tell them of his trip to Vroengard. And when Hope finally fell asleep, he bade them farewell and returned to the night. He next sought out Jode, whom he found reading scrolls by candlelight while his wife, Helen, slept. When Aragorn knocked and stuck his face into the tent, the scarred, thin-faced man put aside his scrolls and left the tent to join Aragorn. Jode had many questions, and while Aragorn did not answer them all, he answered enough that he thought Jode would be able to guess much of what was about to happen. Afterward, Jode laid a hand on Aragorn's shoulder.
I don't envy you the task that lies ahead. Brom would be proud of your courage.
I hope so.
I'm sure of it. If I don't see you again, you should know I've written a small account of your experiences and of the events that led to them.
mainly my adventures with Brom in recovering Saphira's egg. Aragorn gave him a look of surprise. I may not get the opportunity to finish it, but I thought it would make a useful addition to Heslant's work in Domia Aberwyrda. Aragorn laughed. I think that would be most fitting. However, if you and I are both alive and free after tomorrow, there are some things I should tell you which will make your account that much more complete and that much more interesting. I'll hold you to it. Aragorn wandered through the camp for another hour or so, pausing by the fires where men, dwarves, and Urgals still sat awake. He spoke briefly with each of the warriors he met, inquired whether they were being fairly treated, commiserated about their sore feet and short rations, and sometimes exchanged a quip or two. He hoped that by showing himself among them, he could lift the warriors' spirits and strengthen their resolve, and thus spread a sense of optimism throughout the army. The Urgals, he found, were in the best mood. They seemed delighted about the upcoming battle and the opportunities for glory that it would provide. He had another purpose as well, to spread false information. Whenever someone asked him about attacking Urubane, he hinted that he and Saphira would be among the battalion to besiege the northwestern section of the city wall. He hoped that Galbatorix's spies would repeat the lie to the king as soon as the alarms woke Galbatorix the following morn. As he looked into the faces of those listening to him, Aragorn could not help but wonder which, if any, were Galbatorix's servants. The thought made him uncomfortable, and he found himself listening for footsteps behind him when he moved from one fire to the next. At last, when he was satisfied that he had spoken to enough warriors to ensure that the information would reach Galbatorix, he left the fires behind and made his way to a tent that was set slightly away from the others, by the southern edge of the camp. He knocked on the center pole, once, twice, three times. There was no response, so he knocked again, this time louder and longer. A moment later, he heard a sleepy groan and the rustle of shifting blankets. He waited patiently until a small hand pulled aside the entrance flap, and the witch-child Elva emerged. She wore a dark robe much too large for her, and by the faint light of a torch some yards away, he could see a frown upon her sharp little face. "What do you want, Aragorn?" she demanded. "Can't you tell?" Her frown deepened. "No, I can't. Only that you want something badly enough to wake me in the middle of the night, which even an idiot could see. What is it? I get little enough rest as it is, so this had best be important." "It is." He spoke without interruption for several minutes, describing his plan, then said, "Without you, it won't work. You're the point upon which it all turns." She gave an ugly laugh. "Such irony. The mighty warrior relying upon a child to kill the one he cannot. Will you help?" The girl looked down and scuffed her bare foot against the ground. "If you do, all this," he motioned toward the camp and the city beyond, "may end far sooner, and then you will not have to endure quite so much."
"I'll help." She stamped her foot and glared at him. "You don't have to bribe me. I was going to help anyway. I'm not about to let Galbatorix destroy the Varden just because I don't like you. You're not that important, Aragorn. Besides, I made a promise to Nasawada, and I intend to keep it." She cocked her head. "There's something you're not telling me. Something you're afraid Galbatorix will find out before the attack. Something about..."
The sound of clanking chains interrupted her. For a moment Aragorn was confused. Then he realized the sound was coming from the city. He put his hand on his sword. "Ready yourself," he said to Elva. "We may have to leave at once." Without argument, the girl turned around and disappeared inside the tent. Reaching out with his mind, Aragorn contacted Saphira. "Do you hear it?"
"Yes."
"If we have to, we'll meet you by the road." The clanking continued for a short while. Then there was a hollow boom, followed by silence. Aragorn listened as intently as he could, but heard nothing more. He was just about to cast a spell to increase the sensitivity of his ears, when there was a dull thud, accompanied by a series of sharp clacks. Then another, and another. A shiver of horror ran down Aragorn's spine. The sound was unmistakably that of a dragon walking on stone. But what a dragon, to hear its steps from over a mile away! Shrooken, he thought, and his gut clenched with dread. Throughout the camp, alarm horns blared, and men, dwarves, and Urgles lit torches as the army scrambled to wakefulness. Aragorn spared Elva a sideways glance as she hurried out of the tent, followed by Greta, the old woman who was her caretaker. The girl had donned a short red tunic, over which she wore a male hauberk just her size. The footsteps in Urabain ceased. The dragon's shadowy bulk blotted out most of the lanterns and watchlights in the city. "How big is he?" Aragorn wondered, dismayed. Bigger than Gleda, that was certain. As big as Belgabad? Aragorn could not tell, not yet. Then the dragon leaped up and out from the city, and he unfurled his massive wings, and their opening was like 100 black sails filling with wind. When he flapped, the air shook as if from a clap of thunder, and throughout the countryside, dogs bayed and roosters crowed. Without thinking, Aragorn crouched, feeling like a mouse hiding from an eagle. Elva tugged on the hem of his tunic.
"We should go," she insisted.
"Wait," he whispered. "Not yet." Great swathes of stars vanished as Shrooken wheeled across the sky, climbing higher and higher. Aragorn tried to guess the dragon's size from the outline of his shape, but the night was too dark and the distance too hard to determine. Whatever Shrooken's exact proportions, he was frighteningly large. At only a century of age, he ought to have been smaller than he was, but Galbatorix seemed to have accelerated his growth, even as he had thorns. As he watched the shadow drifting above, Aragorn hoped with all his might that Galbatorix was not with the dragon, or if he was, that he would not bother to examine the minds of those below. If he did, he would discover...
"Eldunari," gasped Elva. "That's what you're hiding."
Behind her, the girl's caretaker frowned with puzzlement and started to ask a question.
"Quiet," growled Aragorn.
Elva opened her mouth, and he clamped his hand over it, silencing her.
"Not here, not now," he warned.
She nodded, and he removed his hand. At that very moment, a bar of fire as wide as the Anora River arced across the sky. Shrooken whipped his head back and forth, spraying the torrent of blinding flames above the camp and the surrounding fields, and the night filled with a sound like a crashing waterfall. Heat stung Aragorn's upturned face. Then the flames evaporated like mist in the sun, leaving behind a throbbing afterimage and a smoky, sulphurous smell. The huge dragon turned and flapped once more, shaking the air, before his formless black shape glided back down toward the city and settled among the buildings. Footsteps followed, then the clanking of the chains, and finally the echoing crack of a gate slamming shut. Aragorn released the breath he had been holding and swallowed, though his throat was dry. His heart was pounding so hard it was painful. "We have to fight that?" he thought, all his old fears rushing back.
"Why did he attack?"
asked Elva in a small, fearful voice.
"He wanted to frighten us," Aragorn frowned.
"Or distract us." He searched through the mines of the Varden until he found Jormungandr, then gave the warrior instructions to check that all the sentries were still at their posts and to redouble the watch for the remainder of the night. To Elva he said, "Were you able to feel anything from Shrooken?"
The girl shuddered. "Pain. Great pain. And anger, too. If he could, he would kill every creature he met and burn every plant until there were none left. He's utterly mad."
Is there no way to reach him?
None. The kindest thing to do would be to release him from his misery.
The knowledge made Aragorn sad. He had always hoped that they might be able to save Shrookan from Galbatorix. Subdued, he said, "We had best be off. Are you ready?" Elva explained to her caretaker that she was leaving, which displeased the old woman, but Elva soothed her worries with a few quick words. The girl's power to see into others' hearts never ceased to amaze Aragorn, and trouble him as well. Once Greta had granted her consent, Aragorn hid both Elva and himself with magic, and then they set off together toward the hill where Saphira was waiting.
Over the wall and into the moor.
"Must you do that?" asked Elva.
Aragorn paused in the midst of checking the leg straps on Saphira's saddle and looked over to where the girl sat cross-legged on the grass, toying with the links of her mail shirt.
"What?"
he asked. She tapped her lip with a small, pointed fingernail.
"You keep chewing on the inside of your mouth. It's distracting."
After a moment's consideration, she said,
"And disgusting."
With some surprise, he realized that he had bitten the inner surface of his right cheek until it was covered with several bloody sores. "Sorry," he said, and healed himself with a quick spell. He had spent the deepest part of the night meditating, thinking not of what was to come, nor of what had been, but only of what was. The touch of the cool air against his skin, the feel of the ground beneath him, the steady flow of his breath, and the slow beat of his heart as it marked off the remaining moments of his life. Now, however, the morning star Éardale had risen in the east, heralding the arrival of dawn's first light, and the time had come to ready themselves for battle. He had inspected every inch of his equipment, adjusted the harness of the saddle until it was perfectly comfortable for Saphira, emptied the saddlebags of everything but the chest that contained Gleda's Eldunari and a blanket for padding, and buckled and rebuckled his sword belt at least 5 times. He finished examining the straps on the saddle, then jumped off Saphira. "Stand up," he said. Elva gave him a look of annoyance, but did as she was asked, brushing grass from the side of her tunic. Moving quickly, he ran his hands over her thin shoulders and tugged on the edge of her mail hauberk to ensure that it was sitting properly. "Who made this for you?"
"A pair of charming dwarf brothers called Umar and Ulmar."
Her cheeks dimpled as she smiled at him.
"They didn't think I needed it, but I was very persuasive."
"I'm sure she was,"
Saphira said to Aragorn. He suppressed a smile. The girl had spent a goodly portion of the night talking with the dragons, beguiling them as only she could. However, Aragorn could tell that they also feared her, even the older ones, such as Valdur, for they had no defense against Elva's power. No one did. "And did Umar and Ulmar give you a blade to fight with?" he asked. Elva frowned.
"Why would I want that?"
He stared at her for a moment, then he fetched his old hunting knife, which he used when eating, and had her tie it around her waist with a leather thong. "Just in case," he said when she protested. "Now, up you go." She obediently climbed onto his back and locked her arms around his neck. He had carried her to the hill in that manner, which had been uncomfortable for them both, but she could not keep pace with him on foot. He carefully climbed up Saphira's side to the peak of her shoulders. As he clung to one of the spikes that protruded from her neck, he twisted his body so that Elva was able to pull herself into the saddle. Once he felt the girl's weight leave him, Aragorn dropped back to the ground. He tossed his shield up to her, then lunged forward, arms outstretched, when it nearly pulled her off Saphira. "Have you got it?" he asked.
"Yes," she said, tugging the shield onto her lap.
She made a shooing motion with one hand.
"Go, go,"
holding Brisinger's pommel to keep the sword from tangling between his legs. Aragorn ran to the top of the hill and knelt on one knee, staying as low as he could. Behind him, Saphira crawled partway up the rise, then pressed herself flat against the ground and snaked her head through the grass until it was next to him, and she could see what he saw. A thick column of humans, dwarves, elves, Urgals, and weercats streamed out of the Varden's camp. In the flat grey light of early dawn, the figures were difficult to make out, especially because they carried no lights. The column marched across the sloping fields toward Urabane, and when the warriors were about half a mile from the city, they divided into three lines. One positioned itself before the front gate, one turned toward the southeastern part of the curtain wall, and one went toward the northwestern part. It was the last group that Aragorn had hinted he and Saphira were going to accompany. The warriors had wrapped rags around their feet and weapons, and they kept their voices to a whisper. Still, Aragorn could hear the occasional bray of a donkey or the whinny of a horse, and a number of dogs were barking at the procession. The soldiers on the walls would soon notice the activity, most likely when the warriors began to move the catapults, ballistae, and siege towers that the Varden had already assembled and placed in the fields before the city. Aragorn was impressed that the men, dwarves, and Urgals were still willing to go into battle after seeing Shrukan. "They must have a great deal of faith in us," he said to Saphira. The responsibility weighed heavily upon him, and he was keenly aware that if he and those with him failed, few of the warriors would survive.
"Yes, but if Shrukan flies out again, they will scatter like so many frightened mice."
"Then we'd best not let that happen." A horn sounded in Urabane, and then another and another, and lights began to appear throughout the city as lanterns were unshuttered and torches lit.
"Here we go," Aragorn murmured, his pulse quickening.
Now that the alarm had been raised, the Varden abandoned all attempts at secrecy. To the east, a group of elves on horseback set off at a gallop toward the hill that backed the city, planning to ride up the side of it and attack the wall along the top of the immense shelf that hung over Urabane. In the center of the Varden's mostly empty camp, Aragorn saw what appeared to be Saphira's glittering shape. On the illusion sat a lone figure, which he knew bore a perfect copy of his own features, holding a sword and shield. The duplicate of Saphira raised her head and spread her wings. Then she took flight and loosed a stirring roar.
"They do a good job of it, don't they?" he said to Saphira.
"Elves understand how a dragon is supposed to look and behave, unlike some humans."
The shadow Saphira landed next to the northernmost group of warriors. Although Aragorn noticed the elves were careful to keep her some distance from the men and dwarves, so that they would not brush up against her and discover that she was as insubstantial as a rainbow. The sky lightened as the Varden and their allies gathered in orderly formations at each of the three locations outside the walls. Inside the city, Galbatorix's soldiers continued to prepare for the assault, but it was obvious as they ran about the battlements that they were panicked and disorganized. However, Aragorn knew their confusion would not last long.
"Now," he thought, "now! Don't wait any longer!"
He swept his gaze over the buildings, searching for the slightest scrap of red, but none met his eye.
"Where are you, blast it? Show yourself!"
Three more horns sounded, this time the Varden's. A great chorus of shouts and cries rose from the army. Then the Varden's war machines launched their projectiles at the city, archers loosened their arrows, and the ranks of warriors broke and charged toward the seemingly impenetrable curtain wall. The stones, javelins, and arrows appeared to move slowly as they arced across the ground that separated the army from the city. None of the missiles hit the outer wall. It would be pointless trying to batter it down, so the engineers aimed above and beyond. Some of the stones shattered as they struck within Urabane, sending dagger-like shards in every direction, while others punched through buildings and bounced up the streets like giant marbles. Aragorn thought how horrible it would be to wake amid such confusion, with large chunks of stone raining down. Then activity elsewhere caught his attention, as the shadow Saphira took flight over the running warriors. With three flaps of her wings, she climbed above the wall and bathed the battlements with a tongue of flame that to Aragorn's eye appeared somewhat brighter than normal. The fire, he knew, was real enough, conjured into being by the elves close to the northern part of the wall, who had created and were sustaining the illusion. The apparition of Sephira swooped back and forth over the same stretch of wall, clearing it of soldiers. Once she had, a band of 20-some elves flew from the ground outside the city up to the top of one of the wall towers, so they could continue to keep watch on the apparition as it ranged deeper into Urabain. "If Murtagh and Thorn don't show themselves soon, they're going to start wondering why we're not attacking the other parts of the wall," he said to Sephira.
"They will think we're defending the warriors trying to breach this section," she replied. "Give it time."
Elsewhere along the wall, soldiers fired arrows and javelins at the army below, felling dozens of the Varden. The deaths were unavoidable, but Aragorn regretted them all the same, for the warriors' attacks were merely a distraction. They had little chance of actually surmounting the city's defences. Meanwhile, the siege towers trundled closer, and flights of arrows leaped between their upper levels and the men on the battlements. From above, a ribbon of burning pitch fell across the edge of the overhang and disappeared among the buildings below. Aragorn looked up and saw flashes of light atop the wall that guarded the lip of the precipice. Even as he watched, he saw four bodies tumble over the side. They looked like understuffed dolls as they plummeted toward the ground. The sight pleased Aragorn, for it meant the elves had taken the upper wall. The shadow Sephira looped over the city, lighting several buildings on fire. As she did, a flock of arrows shot up from archers stationed on a nearby rooftop. The apparition swerved to avoid the darts, and seemingly by accident, crashed into one of the six green elf towers scattered throughout Urabain. The collision looked perfectly real. Aragorn winced with sympathy as he saw the dragon's left wing break against the tower, the bones snapping like stalks of dry grass. The imitation Sephira roared and thrashed as she spiraled down to the streets. The buildings hid her after that, but her roars were audible for miles around, and the flame she seemed to breathe painted the sides of the houses and lit the underside of the stone shelf that hung over the city.
"I would never have been so clumsy," sniffed Sephira.
"I know." A minute passed. The tension within Aragorn increased to a nearly unbearable level.
"Where are they?"
he growled, clenching his fist. With every passing second, it became increasingly likely the soldiers would discover that the dragon they thought they had forced down did not actually exist. Sephira saw them first.
"There,"
she said, showing him with her mind. Like a ruby blade dropped from above, Thorn plunged out of an opening hidden within the overhang. He fell straight down for several hundred feet, then unfolded his wings just enough to slow himself to a safe speed, before landing in a square close to where the shadow Sephira and the shadow Aragorn had fallen. Aragorn thought he spotted Murtagh on the red dragon, but the distance was too great to be sure. They would have to hope it was Murtagh, because if it was Galbatorix, their plan was almost certainly doomed to failure.
"There must be tunnels in the stone," he said to Sephira.
More dragon fire erupted from between the buildings. Then the apparition of Sephira hopped above the rooftops, and like a bird with an injured wing, fluttered a short distance before sinking to the ground again. Thorn followed. Aragorn did not wait to see more. He spun around, ran back along Sephira's neck, and threw himself into the saddle behind Elva. It took just a few seconds to slip his legs into the straps and tighten two on each side. He left the rest loose. They would only slow him later. The uppermost strap held Elva's legs also. Swiftly chanting the words, he cast a spell to hide the three of them. When the magic took effect, he experienced the usual sense of disorientation as his body vanished. It looked to him as if he were hanging a number of feet above a dark, dragon-shaped pattern pressed into the plants of the hill. The moment he finished the spell, Sephira surged forward. She jumped off the crest of the hill and flapped hard, struggling to gain height.
"It's not very comfortable, is it?" said Elva, as Aragorn took his shield from her.
"No, not always," he replied.
raising his voice to be heard over the wind. In the back of his mind, he could feel Glader and Umaroth and the other Eldunari watching as Saphira angled downward and dove toward the Varden's camp.
"Now we will have our revenge," said Glader.
Aragorn hunched low over Elva as Saphira gained speed. Gathered in the center of the camp, he saw Blodgarm and his 10 elven spellcasters, as well as Arya, who carried the Dauthdert. They each had a 30-foot-long piece of rope tied around their chests, under their arms. At the other end, all the ropes were bound to a log as thick as Aragorn's thigh, and equal in length to a fully-grown Urgal. When Saphira swooped toward the camp, Aragorn signaled them with his mind, and two of the elves threw the log into the air. Saphira caught it with her talons, the elves jumped, and a moment later Aragorn felt a jolt as Saphira dipped as she took up their weight. Through her body, Aragorn saw the elves, the ropes, and the log wink out of sight, as the elves cast a spell of invisibility, the same as he had. Flapping mightily, Saphira climbed 1,000 feet above the ground, high enough that she and the elves below could easily clear the walls and buildings of the city. To their left, Aragorn glimpsed first Thorn, and then the shadow Saphira, as they chased each other on foot through the northern part of the city. The elves controlling the apparition were trying to keep Thorn and Murtagh so busy physically that neither of them would have the opportunity to attack with their minds. If they did, or if they caught the apparition, they would quickly realize they had been fooled. "Just a few more minutes," Aragorn thought. Over the fields flew Saphira, over the catapults with their devoted attendants, over banks of archers with their arrows stuck in the ground in front of them, like tufts of white-topped reeds, over a siege tower and over the warriors on foot, men, dwarves and Urgals hiding beneath their shields as they rushed ladders toward the curtain wall. And among them, elves, tall and slender, with their bright helms and their long-bladed spears and narrow-bladed swords. Then Saphira soared past the wall itself. Aragorn felt a strange twinge as Saphira reappeared beneath him, and he found himself looking at the back of Elva's head. He assumed that Arya and the other elves hanging below them had become visible as well. Aragorn bit off a curse and ended the spell that had concealed them. Galbatorix's wards, it seemed, would not allow them to enter the city unseen. Saphira hastened her flight toward the citadel's massive gate. Below them, Aragorn heard shouts of fear and astonishment, but he paid them no heed. Murtagh and Thorn were the ones he was worried about, not the soldiers. Bringing in her wings, Saphira dove toward the gate. Just when it looked as if she was going to slam into it, she turned and reared upright while backflapping to slow herself. When she had reached a near stop, she allowed herself to drift downward until the elves were safely on the ground. Once they had cut themselves free of the ropes and moved out of the way, Saphira landed in the courtyard before the gate, jarring both Aragorn and Elva with the force of the impact. Aragorn yanked on the buckles of the straps that held him and Elva in the saddle. Then he helped the girl down from Saphira's back, and they hurried after the elves toward the gate. The entrance to the citadel took the form of 2 giant black doors, which met in a point high above. They looked to be made of solid iron and were studded with hundreds, if not thousands, of spiked rivets, each the size of Aragorn's head. The sight was daunting. Aragorn could not imagine a less inviting entrance. Spear in hand, Arya ran to the sally port set within the left-hand door. The port was visible only as a thin, dark seam that outlined a rectangle barely wide enough for a single man to pass through. Within the rectangle was a horizontal strip of metal, perhaps 3 fingers wide and thrice as long, that was slightly lighter than its surroundings. As Arya neared the door, the strip sank inward 1/2 inch, then slid to the side with a rusty scrape. A pair of owlish eyes peered out of the dark interior.
"Who are you, then?" demanded a haughty voice. "State your business or be gone."
Without hesitation, Arya jabbed the Dauthdert through the open slot. A gurgle emanated from within. Then Aragorn heard the sound of a body falling to the floor. Arya pulled the lance back and shook the blood and scraps of flesh from the barbed blade. Then she grasped the haft of the weapon with both hands, placed the tip of it along the right seam of the sallyport, and said, "Verma!" Aragorn squinted and turned aside as a fierce blue flame appeared between the lance and the gate. Even from several feet away, he could feel the heat. Her face contorted with strain, Arya pressed the blade of the spear into the gate, slowly cutting through the iron. Sparks and drops of molten metal poured out from underneath the blade and skittered across the paved ground like grease on a hot pan, causing Aragorn and the others to step back. As she worked, Aragorn glanced in the direction of Thorn and the shadow Saphira. He could not see them, but he could still hear roars and the crash of breaking masonry. Elva sagged against him, and he looked down to see that she was shaking and sweating as if she had a fever. He knelt next to her. "Do you want me to carry you?" She shook her head.
"I'll be better once we're inside, and away from... that."
She motioned in the direction of the battle. At the edges of the courtyard, Aragorn saw a number of people, they did not look like soldiers, standing in the spaces between the grand houses, watching what they were doing.
"Scare them off, would you?"
he asked Saphira. She swung her head around and gave a low growl, and the onlookers scurried away. When the fountain of sparks and white-hot metal ceased, Arya kicked at the sallyport until, on the third kick, the door fell inward and landed on the body of the gatekeeper. A second later, the smell of burning wool and skin wafted out. Still holding the Dathdet, Arya stepped through the dark portal. Aragorn held his breath. Whatever wards Galbatorix had placed on the citadel, the Dathdet ought to allow her to pass through them without harm, even as it had allowed her to cut open the sallyport. But there was always a chance that the king had cast a spell the Dathdet would be unable to counter. To his relief, nothing happened as Arya entered the citadel. Then a group of 20 soldiers rushed toward her, pikes outstretched. Aragorn drew Brisinger and ran to the sallyport, but he dared not cross the threshold of the citadel to join her, not yet. Wielding the spear with the same proficiency as her sword, Arya fought her way through the men, dispatching them with impressive speed.
"Why didn't you warn her?"
exclaimed Aragorn, never taking his eyes off the fight. Elva joined him by the hole in the gate.
"Because they won't hurt her."
The words proved prophetic. None of the soldiers managed to land a blow. The last two men tried to flee, but Arya bounded after them and slew them before they had gone more than a dozen yards down the immense hallway, which was even larger than the four main corridors of Trondheim. When all of the soldiers were dead, Arya pulled the bodies aside so that there was a clear path to the sallyport. Then she walked down the hallway a good 40 feet, placed the Dathdet on the floor, and slid it back out to Aragorn. As her hand left the spear, she tensed, as if in preparation for a blow. But she seemed to remain unaffected by whatever magics were in the area.
"Do you feel anything?"
Aragorn called. His voice echoed in the interior of the hall. She shook her head.
"As long as we stay clear of the gate, we should be fine."
Aragorn handed the spear to Blodgarm, who took it and entered through the sallyport. Together, Arya and the fur-covered elf went into the rooms on either side of the gate and worked the hidden mechanisms to open it, a task that would have been beyond the same number of humans. The clanking of chains filled the air as the giant iron doors slowly swung outward. Once the gap was wide enough for Saphira, Aragorn shouted, "Stop!" and the doors ground to a halt. Blodgarm emerged from the room to the right, and keeping a safe distance from the threshold, slid the Dathdet to another of the elves. In that fashion, they entered the citadel, one by one. When only Aragorn, Elva, and Saphira remained outside, a terrible roar sounded in the northern part of the city, and for a moment, the whole of Urubain fell silent.
"They have discovered our deception!"
cried the elf Uthinare. He tossed the spear to Aragorn.
"Hurry, Arjatlam!"
"You next," said Aragorn, handing the Dathdet to Elva. Cradling it in the crooks of her arms, she scurried over to join the elves, then pushed the spear back to Aragorn. who grabbed it and ran across the threshold. Turning, he was alarmed to see Thorn rise above the buildings by the far edge of the city. Aragorn dropped to one knee, placed the Darth-Deat on the floor, and rolled it to Saphira. "Quickly!" he shouted. A number of seconds were lost as Saphira fumbled with the lance, struggling to pick it up between the tips of her jaws. At last, she got it between her teeth, and she leaped into the gigantic corridor, scattering the bodies of the soldiers. In the distance, Thorn bellowed and flapped furiously, racing toward the citadel. Speaking in unison, Arya and Blodgarm cast a spell. A deafening clatter sounded within the stone walls, and the iron doors swung shut many times faster than they had opened. They closed with a boom that Aragorn felt through his feet, and then a metal bar, 3 feet thick and 6 feet wide, slid out of each wall and through brackets bolted to the inside of the doors, securing them in place.
"That should hold them for a while," said Arya.
"Not for that long," said Aragorn, looking at the open sally port. Then they turned to see what lay before them. The hallway ran for what Aragorn guessed was close to a quarter mile, which would take them deep inside the hill behind Urabane. At the far end was another set of doors, just as large as the first, but covered in patterned gold that glowed beautifully in the light of the flameless lanterns mounted at regular intervals along the walls. Dozens of smaller passageways branched off to either side, but none were large enough for Shrukan, although Saphira could have fit in many of them. Red banners, embroidered with the outline of the twisting flame that Galbatorix used as his sigil, hung along the walls every 100 feet. Otherwise, the hall was bare. The sheer size of the passageway was intimidating, and its emptiness made Aragorn that much more nervous. He assumed the throne room was on the other side of the golden doors, but he did not think it would be as easy to reach as it appeared. If Galbatorix was even half as cunning as his reputation implied, he would have littered the corridor with dozens, if not hundreds, of traps. Aragorn found it puzzling that the king had not already attacked them. He did not feel the touch of any mind, save those of Saphira and his companions, but he remained acutely aware of how close they were to the king. The entire citadel seemed to be watching them.
"He must know we're here," he said, "all of us."
"Then we had best make haste," said Arya. She took the Darth-Deat from Saphira's mouth. The weapon was covered in saliva.
"Thorough,"
said Arya, and the slime fell to the floor. Behind them, outside the iron gate, there was a loud crash as Thorn landed in the courtyard. He uttered a roar of frustration, then something heavy struck the gate, and the walls rang with the noise. Arya trotted to the front of their group, and Elva joined her. The dark-haired girl placed a hand on the shaft of the spear, so that she too shared its protective powers, and the two of them started forward, leading the way down the long hall as they hurried ever deeper into Galbatorix's lair.
The storm breaks.
"Sir, it's time."
Roran opened his eyes and nodded at the boy with a lantern, who had stuck his head into the tent. The boy hurried off, and Roran leaned over and kissed Katrina on the cheek. She kissed him back. Neither of them had slept. Together they rose and dressed. She finished first, for it took him longer to don his armor and weapons. As he pulled on his gloves, she handed him a slice of bread, a wedge of cheese, and a cup of lukewarm tea. He ignored the bread, took a single bite of cheese, and downed the whole cup of tea at once. They held each other for a moment, and he said,
"If it's a girl, name her something fierce."
"And if it's a boy?"
"The same. Boy or girl, you have to be strong in order to survive in this world."
"I'll do it. I promise."
They released each other, and she looked him in the eye.
"Fight well, my husband."
He nodded, then turned and left, before he lost his composure. The men under his command were assembling by the northern entrance to the camp when he joined them. The only light they had was from the faint glow above and the torches planted along the outer breastwork. In the dim, flickering illumination, the warriors' figures seemed like a pack of shuffling beasts, threatening and alien. Among their ranks were a large number of Urgals, including some Kull. His battalion contained a greater share of the creatures than most, as Nasawada had deemed them more likely to follow orders from him than from anyone else. The Urgals carried the long and heavy siege ladders that would be used to climb over the city walls. Also among the men were a score of elves. Most of their kind would be fighting on their own, but Queen Islanzadi had granted permission for some to serve in the Varden's army as protection against attack by Galbatorix's spellcasters. Roran welcomed the elves and took the time to ask each their name. They answered politely enough, but he had a feeling they did not think very highly of him. That was all right. He did not care for them either. There was something about them he did not trust. They were too aloof, too well practiced, and above all, too different. The dwarves and Urgals, at least, he understood, but not the elves. He could not tell what they were thinking, and that bothered him.
"Greetings, Stronghammer,"
said Nargajvog, in a whisper that could be heard at 30 paces.
"Today we shall win much glory for our tribes."
"Yes, today we will win much glory for our tribes," Roran agreed, moving on. The men were nervous. Some of the younger ones looked as if they might be sick, and some were, which was only to be expected. But even the older men seemed tense, short-tempered, and either overly talkative or overly withdrawn. The cause was obvious enough. Shrukan. There was little Roran could do to help them, other than to hide his own fears and hope that the men did not lose their courage entirely. The sense of anticipation that clung to everyone there, himself included, was dreadful. They had sacrificed much in order to reach this point, and it was not just their lives that were at risk in the battle to come. It was the safety and well-being of their families and descendants, as well as the future of the land itself. All of their prior battles had been similarly fraught, but this was the final one. This was the end. One way or another, there would be no more battles with the Empire after this day. The thought hardly felt real. Never again would they have the chance to kill Galbatorix. And while confronting Galbatorix had seemed fine enough in conversations late at night, now that the moment was almost upon them, the prospect was terrifying. Roran sought out Horst and the other villagers from Carvajal, and the lot of them formed a knot within the battalion. Birgit was among the men, clutching an axe that looked freshly sharpened. He acknowledged her by lifting his shield, as he might a mug of ale. She returned the gesture, and he allowed himself a grim smile. The warriors muffled their boots and feet with rags, then stood waiting for the order to depart. It soon arrived, and they marched out of the camp, doing their best to keep their arms and armor from making noise. Roran led his warriors across the field to their place before the front gate of Uruvane, where they joined two other battalions, one led by his old commander, Martland Redbeard, and one led by Jormunder. The alarm went up in Uruvane soon afterward, so they pulled the rags off their weapons and feet and prepared to attack. A few minutes later, the Varden's horns sounded the advance, and they set off at a run across the dark ground toward the immensity of the city wall. Roran took a place at the forefront of the charge. It was the fastest way to get himself killed, but the men needed to see him braving the same dangers they faced. It would, he hoped, stiffen their spines and keep them from breaking rank at the first sign of serious opposition. For whatever happened, Uruvane would not be easy to take. Of that he was sure. They ran past one of the siege towers, the wheels of which were over 20 feet high, and creaked like a set of rusty hinges. And then they were on open ground. Arrows and javelins rained upon them from the soldiers atop the battlements. The elves shouted in their strange tongue, and by the faint light of dawn, Roran saw many of the arrows and spears turn and bury themselves harmlessly in the dirt. But not all. A man behind him uttered a desperate cry, and Roran heard a clatter of armour as men and Urgals leaped aside to avoid stepping on the fallen warrior. Roran did not look back, nor did he or those with him slow their headlong dash toward the wall. An arrow struck the shield he held over his head. He barely felt the impact. When they arrived at the wall, he moved to the side, shouting, "Ladders! Make way for the ladders!" The men parted to allow the Urgals carrying the ladders to move forward. The ladder's great length meant that the Cull had to use poles made of trees lashed together to push them upright. Once the ladders touched the wall, they sagged inward under their own weight, so that the upper two-thirds lay flat against the dressed stone and slid from side to side, threatening to fall. Roran elbowed his way back through the men and grabbed one of the elves, Othiara, by the arm. She gave him a look of anger, which he ignored.
"Keep the ladders in place," he shouted. "Don't let the soldiers push them away."
She nodded and began to chant in the ancient language, as did the other elves. Turning, Roran hurried back to the wall. One of the men was already starting to climb the nearest ladder. Roran grabbed him by the belt and pulled him off.
"I'll go first," he said.
"Stronghammer." Roran slung his shield over his back, then began to climb, hammer in hand. He had never been fond of heights, and as the men and Urgals grew smaller below him, he felt increasingly uneasy. The feeling just grew worse when he reached the section of the ladder that lay flat against the wall, for he could no longer wrap his hands all the way around the rungs, nor could he get a good foothold. Only the first few inches of his boots would fit on the bark-covered branches, and he had to move carefully to ensure that they did not slip off. A spear flew past him, close enough that he felt the wind on his cheek. He swore and kept climbing. He was less than a yard from the battlements when a soldier with blue eyes leaned over the edge and looked straight at him.
"Bah!"
Roran shouted, and the soldier flinched and stepped back. Before the man had time to recover, Roran scrambled up the remaining rungs and hopped over the battlements to land on the walkway along the top of the wall. The soldier he had scared stood several feet in front of him, holding a short archer's sword. The man's head was turned to the side as he shouted at a group of soldiers farther down the wall. Roran's shield was still on his back, so he swung his hammer at the man's wrist. Without the shield, Roran knew he would have difficulty fending off a trained swordsman. His safest course was to disarm his opponent as quickly as possible. The soldier saw what he intended and parried the blow. Then he stabbed Roran in the belly. Or rather, he tried to. Aragorn's spells stopped the tip of the blade a quarter inch from Roran's gut. Roran grunted, surprised, then knocked aside the blade and brained the man with three rapid strikes. He swore again. It was a bad beginning. Up and down the wall, more of the Varden tried to climb over the battlements. Few made it. Clumps of soldiers waited at the top of most every ladder, and reinforcements were streaming onto the walkway from the stairs to the city. Baldur joined him. He had used the same ladder as Roran, and together they ran toward a ballista manned by 8 soldiers. The ballista was mounted near the base of one of the many towers that rose out of the wall, each of which stood about 200 feet apart. Behind the soldiers and the tower, Roran saw the illusion of Saphira that the elves had created, flying over and around the wall, breathing fire on it. The soldiers were smart. They grabbed their spears and poked at him and Baldur, keeping them at a distance. Roran tried to catch one of the spears, but the man wielding it was too fast, and Roran nearly got stabbed again. A moment more, and he knew the soldiers would overwhelm him and Baldur. Before that could happen, an Urgal pulled himself over the edge of the wall behind the soldiers, then lowered his head and charged, bellowing and swinging the iron-bound club he carried. The Urgal struck one man in the chest, breaking his ribs, and another on the hip, breaking his pelvis. Either injury ought to have incapacitated the soldiers, but as the Urgal bulled past them, the two men picked themselves off the stone as if nothing had happened, and proceeded to stab the Urgal in the back. A sense of doom settled upon Roran. "We'll have to bash in their skulls or take off their heads if we're going to stop them," he growled to Baldur. Keeping his eyes on the soldiers, he shouted to the Varden behind them, "They can't feel pain!" Out over the city, the illusionary Saphira crashed into a tower,
Everyone but Roran paused to look. He knew what the elves were doing. Jumping forward, he slew one of the soldiers with a blow to the temple. He used his shield to shove the next soldier aside. Then he was too close for their spears to be of any use, and he was able to make short work of them with his hammer. Once he and Baldur had killed the rest of the soldiers around the ballista, Baldur looked at him with an expression of despair.
"Did you see? Saphira!"
"She's fine."
"But..."
"Don't worry about it, she's fine." Baldur hesitated, then accepted Roran's word, and they rushed at the next clump of soldiers. Soon afterward, Saphira, the real Saphira, appeared over the southern part of the wall as she flew toward the citadel, prompting cheers of relief from the Varden. Roran frowned. She was supposed to remain hidden for the whole of her flight.
"Frithia, Frithia,"
he said quickly under his breath. He remained visible.
"Blast it,"
he thought. Turning, he said, "Back to the ladders."
"Why?"
demanded Baldur as he grappled with another soldier. Uttering a ferocious shout, he pushed the man off the wall into the city.
"Stop asking questions! Move!"
Side by side, they fought their way through the line of soldiers that separated them from the ladders. It was bloody and difficult, and Baldur received a cut on his left calf, behind his greave, and a severe bruise on one of his shoulders, where a spear nearly pierced his mail shirt. The soldiers' immunity to pain meant that killing them was the only way to stop them, and killing them was no easy task. Also, it meant that Roran dared not show mercy. More than once he thought he had killed a soldier, only to have the wounded man rear up and strike at him while he was engaged with another opponent. And there were so many soldiers on the walkway, he began to fear that he and Baldur would never make it off. When they reached the nearest ladder, he said,
"Here! Stay here!"
If Baldur was puzzled, he did not show it. They held off the soldiers by themselves until another two men climbed up the ladder and joined them, then a third. And at last, Roran began to feel as if they had a good chance at pushing back the soldiers and capturing that segment of the wall. Even though the attack had been devised as only a distraction, Roran saw no reason to treat it as such. If they were going to risk their lives, they might as well get something out of it. They needed to clear the walls anyway. Then they heard Thorn roar with rage, and the red dragon appeared over the tops of the buildings, winging his way toward the citadel. Roran saw a figure he thought was Murtagh on his back, crimson sword in hand.
"What does it mean?"
shouted Baldur between sword strokes.
"It means the game is up," Roran replied. "Brace yourself. These bastards are in for a surprise."
He had barely finished speaking when the voices of the elves sounded above the noise of the battle, eerie and beautiful, as they sang in the ancient language. Roran ducked under a spear and poked the end of his hammer into a soldier's belly, knocking the wind from the man's lungs. The soldiers might not be able to feel pain, but they still had to breathe. As the soldier struggled to recover, Roran slipped past his guard and crushed his throat with the rim of his shield. He was about to attack the next man when he felt the stone tremble beneath his feet. He retreated until his back was pressed against the battlements, then widened his stance for balance. One of the soldiers was foolish enough to rush him at that very moment. As the man ran toward him, the trembling grew stronger. Then the top of the wall rippled like a blanket being tossed, and the onrushing soldier, as well as most of his companions, fell and remained prone, helpless to rise as the earth continued to shake. From the other side of the wall tower that separated them from Urbane's main gate came a sound like a mountain breaking. Fan-shaped jets of water sprayed into the air, and then with a great noise, the wall over the gate shuddered and began to crumble inward. And still the elves sang. As the motion beneath his feet subsided, Roran sprang forward and killed three of the soldiers before they were able to stand. The rest turned